This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
Another working on things like climate change in the Himalayan region and other kinds of problems like that. So sometimes I approach an issue as if I'm a scientist thinking about it in many of the terms like Jillian mentioned in terms of thinking about parts per million of different sorts of odds and ends. But often I come to it as a humanist because when you take a look at the world that's inhabited by Tibetologists, people like Jillian and others who study Tibet, they call themselves that, and I interface with that world as well. I do not pretend to be one. That would take me another career and a half, and I just don't have the time left to be able to do that. But my point is that I sit in these intersections of things, and so I try very hard to work across the boundaries as well as I can, and when I can't do it myself, then I go ask for help. And so perhaps some of you will help me across some of the boundaries that you see me having some difficulties with, and we'll see whether or not I can not necessarily convince you of things, but I can certainly tell a story about the stones I'm about to describe that come from Western Tibet. So as an archaeologist, I deal with things. I deal with objects. And as we've heard yesterday and today as well, is that archaeologists often approach those objects in very specific ways. We create typologies. We look at the material substances that they are created from. We make sense of the object from our archaeological perspective, which is really all about primarily putting things into categories so that we can tell a different kind of story. And so most of the objects I've dealt with over the course of my career have been the quotidian. Broken pieces of bone, pottery, shards of lithic materials, basically garbage. And so I spend a lot of time rooting around, 10,000-year-old, 5,000-year-old, 3,000-year-old garbage. But there are moments in time when we encounter things that are somewhat unfamiliar to us. That is, we find these sorts of things. Now, I did not find these. I don't make an effort to claim that I did. But I challenge you just for a moment, and I don't want to take up too much of our time with the challenge, to tell me what you think these are. Archaeologists are not allowed to answer. Because you might actually know. Okay, so this is kind of like what we saw earlier in your presentation just now. Tell me what you see. Well, what you see are swords. They're very small, so they're little swords if they're swords. You can, saw, sure. Anybody else? Sorry? Seahorses, wow. That's one I've never heard in this conversation before. I asked my students in my introductory archaeology class what these were, and I got the most amazing responses, but never got seahorses. Bottle opener. Well, sadly, there were no bottles when these were made. These were from the Maya region in Guatemala. They're actually representations of deities, as far as the archaeologists know. If you look carefully, nose, mouth, this is part of a headdress. And so thinking about making these objects, they had to actually work with the substance that was given to them. This is actually the natural circles in the stone that wash out. They dissolve chemically. The rest of it is flint or chert that then gets napped into those shapes. They're placed in tombs with the elites to signify their relationship with those individuals in time and space. So when we get objects like this, we often try then to think about stories that we would like to be able to tell. And I grant very fully that what I'm trying to do now is to get into the mind, if you will, of people in the distant past. And if we have trouble doing it with people that we know about today, talking with one another about things in this room, then you can imagine what that's like trying to figure out what happened in someone's mind 3,000 years ago. But yet, this is what we do. We try to make relatively solid inferences about the way things look and the connections that those things have in order to tell stories about the past that actually enlighten us in some manner, actually tell us something about the trajectory of human history. They tell us something about the people that once lived in these areas as part of our common humanity. And so when we encounter these objects, we make a special effort then to make sense of them. But there is a sad joke that archaeologists tell about themselves and these objects. That is, whenever we find something that we really can't easily immediately explain, we say, well, that's just a ceremonial object. And, sometimes we actually might be right, but there are many times when we're actually not right at all. But we make that assumption just because we can. So I'm going to turn now to the objects I'm going to deal with this afternoon. And what's really been fascinating is hearing what Jillian's talk was like, hearing what your talk was like, hearing some of the other presentations today. It's going to provide me with some other ways to help us think about what these objects happen to be. So I'm going to be talking about a particular kind of object on the Tibetan Plateau called a do-ring. And this is a set of do-ring from a site in western Tibet. And they're glossed as standing stone. And that's all the gloss means right then. So there, as you will see, though, there are all sorts of do-ring that find themselves on the Tibetan Plateau. Here's one of the most famous ones in the center. That do-ring is actually called the Zhol stone, and that's actually demarcating the boundary between Tang China and Tibet in the 6th century AD, making it very clear that this is ours, this is yours, please go away now and leave us alone, because actually the Tibetans had removed the Tang king, or the Tang emperor at this time in deep history. So this is a very famous do-ring, very special one. And there's some other ones on the plateau like this as well. Other times, though, you run into arrays of these, and you can see that there are similarities, but also significant differences as well. These are in these rather large arrays. Some of them are even larger than this, with thousands of stones lined up, not so much in geometric patterns, but in these kind of long linear lines of objects placed on the landscape. Often interpreted ceremonial. What else? What could they possibly be? We really don't know in many cases what those are. The do-ring, though, that I'm going to be talking about is just a little do-ring right here and a few other ones as well. And I situate this in a site in western Tibet very near the other ones that I showed you. And what I'd like to draw your attention to in this image is not only the do-ring lying on its surface of the ground, but also this peak standing here in the distance. These will all be part of the story that makes the connection between that peak, the do-ring, and ritual practice within the Tibetan world. But to make sense of this, I think we have to go back and take a look now. I put on my Tibetology hat briefly and say we have to talk about two concepts that are common in Tibetological, or in Tibet in general. We have to talk about the term ne, which is on the left-hand side of the image, and we talk about the term ten, which is a relationship of ne. This is where I get in trouble trying to explain these things. So the Tibetologist in here will please forgive me if I overstep my bounds in any real significant way. Ne is glossed in a variety of different ways. It can be called abode, it can be called place, it can be called location. But often how ne is perceived, especially when we begin to think about ritual and ritual activities, is that ne is associated with another gloss that we Westerners use to describe sacred spaces on the landscape, power places, if you will. And the reason we bring it up in that sense is because it's clear that when you talk to Tibetans and read the Tibetan literature about the nature of the plateau is absolutely inhabited with all sorts of different creatures of one kind or another. And Jillian made reference to some of those, under the water, on tops of the mountains, other different places on the landscape, rocks, dirt, all sorts of places that become associated with a particular entity. And that place then absorbs the ne of that entity. So in other words, it's beginning to take on the characteristics, kind of like your Barbie dolls did in a sense. But this is actually then inhabiting the place. What ten then does is it takes that one step further. Ten is often used in the context of a ceremonial vessel that's used to receive something sacred. But in fact, you can also see ten in a very discreet way as well, as being something invited into the receptacle as well. So the ten brings ne into an object. So here's a connectivity then that connects what we might call the sacred to something that is called the more quotidian and becomes part of this nexus. So in this image that you're looking at right here, this is a pilgrimage site that's in western Tibet. It was relatively recently discovered, that is, the cave that was in was opened up. And what you find on this little altar here that's been constructed in front of this series of paintings is objects people bring to this location to act as, you know, we would call them offerings. And these are simply just things that are being placed there in what I would call propitiation of that sacred spot, the ne of that spot. And what becomes interesting then is that you can actually take, you might not take these things away, but you can take dirt or other objects from this location that has the ne with it, and you take that home. It becomes part of your assemblage, if you will, of things that you might like to have that reflect these things. So ne and ten then are part of the way I'm about to interpret my do ring. So now to interpret the do ring, let's go to the archaeological site and what they're found. The site is actually spread across this part of the plateau here, this little mesa. These are relatively late chortens that have been placed on that with other sorts of Tibetan Buddhist architecture in the vicinity. Let's go a little closer and you find that the excavation I'm going to take you to then lies beneath this chorten. So much of the construction of this object then was taken from a house that once existed on this platform right here. And if you look very carefully, there's something odd coming out of this house. It was buried. My Chinese colleague was about to just rip it out of the ground and say, it's just another rock. But in fact, it's not just another rock. It turns out to be a do ring. Now, this do ring has actually been collapsed. It's been pushed over in the context, but it's clearly a do ring. It is about 2 meters in height, and it has a particular shape that you can probably identify on your own. I don't think I need to help you with that. But in any case, you've got this object inside this structure. So that's one do ring that we encountered. You've already seen the other do ring, and it's on the margin of the site. And I'm taking that picture now from on top of one of those chortens looking down to it. And you can see in this particular case, this do ring lies on its side. It's been pushed away. It's been discarded, appears to have been discarded. The other one was unknown. This one is simply pushed aside and not part of the context of the site, at least as far as we could tell as we did the excavations. There are structure remains out here that appear to be contemporaneous with that building that I saw that you saw the excavations of, but this material here is quite different. It's not part of an embedded construction. It's something that we'll talk about in a moment. So keep that in your mind's eye, as I say, and see where we go with this idea. So how do we interpret these? Well, going back to my Tibetanological roots, the way in which we begin to look at these then is that this is our excavation here. This is a structure that was identified by John Beleza on the Changtang Plateau, much above where we work right now. And if you look very carefully, here's our standing stone. He's got a standing stone that he calls a stela down here. There's very direct similarities between the two constructions of these homes. These are houses of people. And the way in which I've interpreted, this is the stone itself in John's image, is that I've called these things domestic do-ring. And what I mean by domestic do-ring is these are do-ring found in what I call domestic contexts, someone's home. You find them also at the edges of archaeological sites. You saw the one lying on its side. You can also, there's a do ring on the eastern side of the site as well. And when you do survey in the region, you either find other sites that have do ring on east and west, and often then found inside structures like these. And so the way I've interpreted this is that the mountain that I asked you to look at, as you'll see in a moment, is the local home of the Yula, the territorial deity. And the way in which I see the archaeological assemblage then have been created is that what we're doing is we're essentially having this visual notion of there's where the entity sits in this region. And essentially by putting do ring at village margins and in houses, literally what you're doing is you're enacting ne and ten. You're inviting the deity to be part of your village. You're inviting the deity to be in your home. Not every home gets a do ring. In fact, the other ones did not have them as we excavated them. So this is a special thing for this individual. But I think you see my point. We see ne and ten now in operation in the antiquity. And this, again, is an inference. It's not necessarily the truth, but it's a good story in any case, you have to admit. In any case, it seems like this is a good interpretation of why these stones are where they are and what they're likely to represent. So, with that background in mind, then let's turn to now transformations and different connectivities. Now I'm going to take you to Mumbu. And Mumbu, as I pointed out to you, is this location right here. What was interesting about learning about Mumbu is that the Tibetans that worked for us were very reluctant to talk about Mumbu to our Chinese colleagues, but they were really happy to talk about Mumbu to us being the Westerners. And so we were able then to understand more about the connections that Mumbu has today and how stones today are used in this context with the idea of ne and ten. So this is now part of ethnography that we get into, that that we were able to obtain that could never have been done otherwise because they were simply not about to talk to our Chinese colleagues. So when you go to the foot of Mambu, what you find is this. You find a standing stone. And you'll notice something very special about the standing stone as we zoom in. The standing stone has been covered by kata, which are objects, devices that placed around people coming and going. They're marks of honor for individuals. They're, you know, symbols of relationship, if you will, symbols of respect when people are on journey, or also to represent sacrality in many ways. So if you look at the stone, then the stone is very clearly now has taken on different attributes at this point. The standing stone, we have no idea if it was actually standing at this time. That is, it might have been in the vicinity. I don't know if it's antique. I don't know if it's relatively modern. I suspect it's ancient, though. Whether it was standing, I don't know. Has it been re-erected by the local people? We don't know that either. They wouldn't talk much about that. But when you think about then how this stone then was reincorporated back into, if it was in fact standing and was once representing a yola, what you find now is that the stone is probably representing its incorporation into Tibetan Buddhist thinking. And what you're looking at here is an image of the supine demoness. And the supine demoness is Tibet in one sense. And what Buddhism was there to do was essentially to tie the demoness down. And so stones like this then are likely part of this tying down of the wild nature of the Tibetan plateau, creating then a safe space, if you will, for the local deities. The local deities, in fact, then become part of the Buddhist pantheon in this case. And so it's likely then the stone has something to do with that. And if you look carefully at the stone itself, it has Tibetan writing on it, Om Mani Padme Hum, which is obviously, you know, a very famous and potent Tibetan Buddhist mantra. You look around the side as well, and what you find is that there are other installations that were created. These are now relatively recent. And if you look very carefully inside this object, you find some images that are quite surprising on the Tibetan plateau. You don't usually see these things. There's two pictures of the Dalai Lama here and here, and here's the disappeared Panchen Lama from many years ago. So the second time I went to visit the site, these were all gone, put away at some point. But you get the sense then that this place was probably something prehistoric, that is, in the historic period, much like my domestic Do Ring, but now it's standing at the foot of the sacred mountain. It's been incorporated into Buddhist thinking. It has new connections in, if you will, that have been transformed over time to take a place in this modern world. But let's go back just for a moment to our fallen Do Ring. And as I said, it looks fallen. It looks like it's essentially ignored. It looks like it's been passed aside in some sense. But if you look more closely, and you pretend if you're an archaeologist for just one moment, and you do something like pick up the rocks, which is, we spend a lot of time doing that, what you find underneath the rocks, and it's not easy to see in this image, here's the standing stone right here, and underneath each one of these smaller rocks is some burning. Something has been brought into the spot, burned, and then a rock placed over top. And when you look more carefully at what has been burned in there, what you find is that's been barley that's been burned in those spaces. So there's something interesting going on then with this connection, that there's the idea still that the Do Ring is an important symbol of the Tibetan past. But it now has been transformed in a very different way, in a very different kind of local individual ritual process that is not part of that Tibetan Buddhist pantheon, if you will, but of a very local expression. So the stone still has its power. It's immutable, but mutable in the same way. It still has its power, but now has been transformed into something else. Even more interesting is to take a look at this little stone right here. And it's, again, the shadow is not good. But the stone, when I asked, what is that stone all about? They said, well, everyone knows what that stone looks like. It looks like Mount Kailash. And Mount Kailash, of course, is a sacred mountain to both Hindus and Tibetan Buddhists. And so what has been taking place then is the Do Ring, in its former domestic context of bringing down the Yule Law, it may not have the Yule Law implicit in it, but yet it now has that transformed sacred meaning to the local inhabitants of this area. So at one time they're doing Tibetan Buddhist activity with the standing stone. In another sense, they're doing something else with a different Do Ring in this location. Finally, why barley? Well, barley, I think, is something that Tibetans uniquely identify as their own. Even though barley is grown all over the world, it's really a Tibetan cultural marker in many ways. It's the fundamental staple of diet. You see it used in all sorts of other ritual activities of one kind or another on the plateau. And so burning barley there, we couldn't get a straight interpretation about what they thought it actually was, but it's quite clear that it is a part of this little ritual process that has very deep symbolic meaning to those local inhabitants. And so I'm going to end without a big theoretical conclusion. I'm not going to try to even make one up at this point. I think it's important, though, just to stress the nature of the transformed connections, the connectivities. The material stays more or less the same, but becomes quite different in terms of the way in which it becomes interpreted through the different lenses of different religious practices and different ideas that begin to permeate the Tibetan plateau. And we can talk about both ritual, religion, resistance as well, when you look at the images of the Dalai Lama and Panchen Lama in these contexts. So I think I'll leave it at that, and thank you very much for your attention.